Hello, I'm Candace.
And I'm Elena.
And this is Cousins on Crime. Welcome to episode one. And just full disclosure, this is like not the first time we've recorded this
We'll get it
episode.
right somehow.
We'll get it right. There's growing pains with this kind of thing, and recording in two different places is much different than recording together. So we're getting things worked out, but I think we've got it worked out. And let us know if we still don't have it worked out. You can email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com if you think we sound terrible. But just give us your feedback. See what you think.
We also have Instagram. It's Cousins on Crime Podcast. So come follow us, and you can also message us there.
We'll be posting photos relevant to each episode, updates on episodes when they're coming out, blah, blee, blah, blue, and all of that. So you're going to want to follow us there. It's going to be essential to your life, probably. Probably. All right, guys. Well, I guess let's just go ahead and hop into this episode. Today, the case I have for you is a cold case from 1976. So sometimes there are cases that are so haunting that hang over a town like a black cloud. And sometimes there are cases that get forgotten, boxed up and shelved in a dusty corner of an evidence room. Time ticks on and we get further and further from the truth. But what if there was something in those boxes all along that could have blown the case wide open, but it was missed all those years ago? The case I have for you today is so horrific that I can't even believe it's never formally been solved, and I can't believe I've never heard of it before because it happened just down the road from where we grew up, Lena, Blue Mound, Texas.
Good old Blue Mound.
Good old Blue Mound. And by the way, you can find all of my sources in the show notes, and we'll always put our sources down in the show notes for your viewing pleasure. So let's get into this. The Joplin family lived in a small three-bedroom, one-bathroom home at 1717 Glen Drive in Blue Mound, Texas. It was about 1,000 square feet, so for this family of five, it was a tight squeeze. You had the oldest brother and the youngest brother sharing a bedroom. And I mean, when you think of 1,000 square feet, I
Pretty small.
remember, yeah, Daniel and I had an apartment that was a one bedroom and it was 1,000 square feet. So I'm
And
just
that's good
trying
for
to,
two people, but a
yeah,
family of five? Whoa.
right. I'm just trying to picture squeezing three bedrooms into that one bedroom apartment. Oh, but those houses were very small back then, those
Especially,
older
in Blue
homes.
Mound, I think all the houses in Blue Mound are pretty small, about that size.
Yeah, well, where we grew up in Saginaw, the houses are pretty small there too. I mean, nothing was open concept back then, and everything was pretty closed off. Lots of really small closets, no walk-ins, just older homes.
The essential need.
Right, but it was a tight squeeze for this family of five. So Blue Mound is a very, very small town. It's just north of Fort Worth, about 45 minutes west of Dallas, and it's adjacent to the town of Saginaw, like I said, where Lena and I grew up. It's very small. It was incorporated just in 1960, and back then was mainly an industry town. As it is today, many industry and distribution centers have been set up there, and I believe Is it still growing today, Lena? I mean, are they
Yeah,
still building?
I don't know about so much as in Blue Mound, but right in the Saginaw area, right next to Blue Mound, it seems to be growing quite a bit. A lot of new houses. It's considered Saginaw, but it's over on that side of the tracks.
Right. Yeah. Well, it may have been back then, and it still is very much an industry town. But back in the 70s, there was only around 2,000 people actually living there. And today, it hasn't grown much. As far as residents are concerned, there's really only about 2,400 people living there today. So just picture a really small town that is basically a blip on a map. It's one of those towns you drive through to get to someplace else. It's not one of those towns that someone has ever heard of, really. And just to give you an idea of what the locals thought about Blue Mound in the 70s, one law enforcement officer was quoted as saying, "There isn't a less intelligent collection of human souls on God's green earth,"
Ouch.
when talking about Blue Mound. So rude.
Yikes.
I mean, he should know. He's out there patrolling the street.
Talking about himself.
So, yeah, and you had mentioned something about the Blue Mound Police Department to me.
Oh, this day and age. Yes, the Blue Mound Police Department, they have a Facebook page, and every time they arrest someone, they plaster their face on Facebook,
That
and
is amazing.
yeah, they'll explain why this person was arrested and whether it be drugs or if they evaded arrest or yeah, they
Social media for the win.
yeah. Right.
I'm just always fascinated how social media, like its grip on society and the access we have to whatever we want at any time now.
Right.
When I was investigating this case, I found it really difficult to really get a grip on a lot of information. I mean, I relied heavily on a couple of detailed articles that were written about it, but it's nothing like today. Like, you could go on the internet and Google and get every single crime scene photo or,
Yeah.
anything
Anybody's
for
comments
modern
about
day.
it. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I'll give you what I can. I'll give you all the details I have about this case. So the Joplin family consisted of Wayne. He was the head of the household. He was 42. His wife, Faye, she was 41, and their three sons, Greg, who was 20, Brian was 17, and Kevin was only 6 years old. So on the night of February 23rd, 1976, the oldest son, Greg, came home after being at his aunt's house for a few hours. He had had a fight with his parents earlier in the evening, and he just went over to his Aunt Alice's house to cool off, blow off steam, get some space. She lived a couple blocks away, so he just went over there. And this kind of feels like our family. We all lived kind of streets away from each other growing up. So he told police that he left his house around 7:30 p.m. and he was at his aunt's house for a few hours. And just FYI, if you can hear thunder in the background, we're having a thunderstorm here and there's nothing I can do about it. So hopefully you don't hear it, but here we go. Hey, maybe it'll set the mood for this
Sound
story.
effects,
Yeah,
okay.
exactly. I'm building in the sound effects, so let's roll with it. So he told police that he was at his aunt's
Yes.
his aunt's house for a few hours. Then he left her house around 10:45 p.m. He drove around for a while before he went home. Okay. In an interview with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Greg said he got home, he unlocked the front door using his key, and when he entered the home, he found his mother lying by the front door, and he said it looked like she was hurt real bad. Okay.
Wow, okay.
Just as he sees her laying there, he heard something, and he sees this shadowy figure coming from the back of the house with a gun. coming towards him. So he
Oh, wow.
grabs his gun that just so happened to be propped up behind the front door. He loaded it and he fired one shot, which later he called a lucky shot because the intruder was hit and fell to the ground. Greg dropped his rifle. He went over to turn on the lamp. And as soon as he flipped on that light, he sees his dad covered in blood, and he saw blood
No.
all over the hallway.
Oh, that is
So
awful.
he hightailed it out of that house. He turns around, he ran out of the house, and he called the Blue Mound Police Department about 11:40. So he told dispatchers, "I came in, I found my whole family shot. I need an officer quick." Now, did you catch what I just said? He
His
called
whole
the
family.
he said his whole family, but he called the Blue Mound Police Department, not 911.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I also had questions about that too. I don't know about you, but I mean, I knew to call 911 when I was little. I knew to call 911. But back in
Right.
that day, I feel like it was more common for people to know their local police department's phone number,
Okay,
because
yeah.
911 wasn't started until the 60s. So it may have been that he had memorized that number as a child, and he was just.
Well, back then, you did remember numbers because we didn't have cell phones to keep numbers in.
Well, and we also didn't have area codes back then.
You're right.
They didn't get area codes till we were kids. I mean, I
Exactly.
remember when I first got a cell phone, that was around the time we started having area codes. So back then, you only had
Yeah.
to remember 7 digits of a number. But more importantly, he gave a clearer reason for why he called the police department in his grand jury testimony later on. So the first responding officer was an officer on patrol that night, 29-year-old Police Chief Gary Irwin. He had never seen anything as heinous or gruesome as the scene he rolled up on that night. And this becomes very clear when he enters the crime scene. He clearly didn't have the training to deal with something of this magnitude.
One,
So
he was 29. That's pretty
he was
young.
29. I was thinking that too, like, that's a baby. 29.
Yeah.
I remember when I was 29, I guess because I'm closing in on 40. I mean, I'm not
Yeah.
closing in on 40, but like, I'm a few years away from 40. So
Right.
29 to me just seems like experienced, but to roll up on something
Still
like
so much
this,
to do, right?
exactly. So he goes in and he notes the deceased that he can see right there. He describes Faye as being nearest the door in a green nightgown. He sees Wayne in the hallway in just a t-shirt and boxers, and he had defensive wounds. His hand was like blown off because he had
Oh,
had it raised
Lord.
up by his face. He continued through the house to the back of the house, and he sees Terry Trice. Terry Trice was 17. And he sees a British model 303 rifle near him. Now, some reports say it was in his hand, other reports say it was laying beside him, but it doesn't really matter, and I'll get to that in just a minute. And he also notes that this particular victim had a pistol under his belt as well. So he carries on through the house, he goes down the hallway. And in one of the back bedrooms, he found Brian, 17, tucked in his bed, but he had
No.
defensive wounds as well. He was shot in his left eye. Ultimately, these are all described as execution style killings.
Okay.
There weren't any details about what exactly they meant by defensive wounds, but I assume that he had also raised an arm or something up by his face because he probably heard the shots. He probably heard mom, dad being shot, because you have to remember, supposedly Terry Trice was still alive until Greg got there. So he would have heard two shots So he probably would have been disturbed
Right.
in bed and then maybe sat up or, didn't have time to get out of bed before he was actually shot. And then lastly, Irwin found Kevin, the 6-year-old, shot in his bed.
No.
Yeah, bless him. The reports say on his bed, so he may have had time since he may have heard the 3 shots, his mom, dad, and then his brother right in the room next to him. And he may have actually had time to crawl out of the covers in an
Oh,
attempt
okay.
to see what was going on, but he was found in his Mickey Mouse pajamas.
Oh,
I
sweet
know,
baby.
just, I know. Everyone died, like I said, of gunshot wounds to the head. So little 6-year-old Kevin was also shot in the head.
All in the head. Okay, so that's very precise.
Yes, it is. It's very precise, and it's not like when you think about motive, or and we'll get to that in a minute, what Greg says was the motive. But when you think about it, someone's that's there for, like, say, a robbery, which is what Greg says he thinks may have happened, they're not gonna execution style shoot everybody in the head. They're gonna fumble around and try and get what they can
Right.
and maybe shoot someone on the way out trying to get out the door, but they're not just going to go in and kill everybody.
Right.
That's not if robbery was the motive. So Greg, once officers arrived, Greg was taken to the hospital to be treated for shock. It was there that they told him that the intruder that he shot was Terry Trice. So this is where we learn his name. And he was a 17-year-old neighborhood kid that was over at their house all the time. He was around the same age as Brian. So presumably they were close friends and Greg knew him. So Greg seems really surprised to hear this news. He was, by all accounts, very surprised that he had shot Terry. And police pressed him to see what he thought the motive could be for the intrusion. And like I said, he said, well, maybe robbery. The police had also informed Greg of which gun was found near Terry. It was a British model 303. And Greg said, the 303? God, was that what he used? That was my gun. He even
Oh.
used my gun. So Greg is seeming like he's very surprised by this. But police found some discrepancies
Okay.
with Greg's account of that night in the timeline and his activities. For one, a neighbor, Martha Boyles, who lived across the street, she was over that night visiting Faye. She left around 8:30 p.m. and she said she didn't see any rifle behind the front door when she left. And I would think she would remember something like that.
Right.
Wouldn't you think?
Well, and if she goes to visit Faye often and notices that there's not usually a gun there, or if there is a gun there, I mean,
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think when you're over at your neighbor's house all the time, you kind of know what's characteristic of their house, like what's missing, what's
right.
normally there. And two, like, I don't know if this lady had children, but I would think even if she didn't, she would be in tune with the fact that, oh, there's a 6-year-old living in this house. There's a gun propped up right behind the front door. And there's
Right.
ammo and all this stuff laying out. That's kind of concerning, Faye. You should probably not have that around little Kevin in his Mickey
Right.
Mouse pajamas, bless him. So I kind of believe that she didn't see anything there. What
Right.
about you?
Yeah,
Don't
I
you
could
think
agree
she
with
would have
that.
noticed that? I mean, I would notice. Even if
Right.
I hadn't been to someone's house, if I had never been over to someone's house, like, say, a new neighbor, say I made friends with a new neighbor and I
Yeah.
went over to their house and I saw a gun propped up behind their front door, I would remember that.
Yeah.
So the
Because
fact
it
that
shouldn't be a
she,
normal thing for a gun just to sit
exactly,
there. Yeah.
right. So I don't believe that it was there. So police conducted interviews not just with Mary, but they interviewed many other neighbors on the street. Many of them heard shots about 10:45 p.m. 3 shots, to be specific.
Okay.
One resident, Marie Rodriguez, said that she saw Terry Trice leave his house and get into a light-colored vehicle around 10:50 p.m. And she recognized Greg Joplin as the driver. They both drove away with the headlights off, and she thought that was weird. Other witnesses had said they had taken note of the lights and that they were on around 11:15 and 11:25 p.m. And one neighbor said they even heard the back door slam really loud. Maybe that was a gunshot too. Who knows?
Oh, okay.
But from the start, this investigation into the case was sloppy. I mean, sloppy is a nice way of putting it.
Okay.
I mean, that's just a nice way. I feel like this is a theme in cold cases. The facts are like often lost forever when the crime scene isn't sealed immediately. I know back in the old days, townspeople were allowed to come and, walk around a crime scene and see what happened and, trample over evidence, and they didn't have the protocols. But I feel like back in the 70s, you should know
Know
better.
better, yeah.
Exactly. And even though Irwin may not have had the training to handle a mass murder, I feel like it's common sense to, I don't know, secure the freaking
And he was police chief at the time.
He was, yes. I mean, I'm not a police officer, so I don't know
But
the
chief.
protocols, the SOPs, whatever in securing a crime scene, but I guarantee you it's not this.
Right,
Okay.
okay.
First, Irwin removed the guns from the house because he thought Terry Trice was still alive. I mean, that could have easily been figured out if he was alive or not. You
Right.
go over to the body and you check for a pulse. Okay, Irwin? Please come to my training session right now. Next, several people who had no affiliation with the investigation. They weren't even law enforcement, they weren't even crime scene analysts, they weren't even coroner, nobody. They got to the house before the CSI people got there.
They were just
They were,
going in the house.
yes, they just handled guns, the spent casings. So they're touching and moving things now. Before pictures are taken, before,
Wow.
right. So Irwin himself, like I said, picked up the guns and moved them. And D Magazine reported that there was even bone fragments being dug out of the sheetrock by civilians. Like they were like, "Oh, dude, this is like a bone fragment, yo."
I wish you could see my face right now. Like, what?
Her face is like, "What, guys?" I mean, no one took GSR samples from Terry's hands, so we don't know if Terry fired a gun, right? We don't know if he fired the gun that was on him.
Okay, so yeah, he just has guns laying next to him, so he had to have shot
Right.
them, right?
Of course. Well, that's the easiest conclusion. When the evidence was logged, they couldn't even get any fingerprints off of the gun that was located next to him, the rifle. So
So it
it
was
had been wiped.
white. Okay.
It had been wiped. Exactly. So
So
he was
he
wearing gloves that weren't there. So,
Make
okay,
it make
he didn't have
sense.
gloves on. Right, exactly. Additionally, the medical examiner's office said that they were only asked to determine the cause of death, and they were not ordered to run any out of the ordinary tests, which to me, I feel like a medical examiner's office doesn't need to be asked to run out of the ordinary tests. I feel like they should also have protocols in place. I mean, it's a mass murder.
Yeah.
It's not like you found someone asleep in their bed who presumably died of a heart attack. It's a mass murder. So
Let's
yes,
open all
let's
avenues.
check for everything. Well, they were asked to look at Terry's clothes for blood, and they did find a very small blood stain on his left pant leg, and there was a tiny spot of blood on the bottom of his shoe. I mean, it was so insignificant that they couldn't even take it as a sample. It was like a pin dot of blood.
Okay. So this tiny
Right.
amount of blood, but there's blood everywhere.
You're smelling what I'm stepping in then? Picking up what I'm
Yeah,
putting
I'm
down.
smelling it.
If he had shot, not if I had shot four people, but if he had shot four people, he would have had not just some blood spatter on his clothing, he would have been covered. And the
You
whole
would
bottom
think.
of his shoe would have been covered in blood, right? Because he would have shot
Yeah.
Faye first, then Wayne, then gone to the back of the house. So he would have stepped over Wayne to go down the hall to shoot Brian and Kevin.
Right.
Kevin! So he would have been covered in blood, but he wasn't. If he was found by the back door, that means he would have had to have, like I said, shot Faye in the living room, shot Wayne in the hallway, gone to the back of the house to kill the two boys, then come back all the way back down the hall, and then he's adding footprints back and forth, right? But that wasn't found.
Right.
Still with me? Now the blood stain on his left pant leg was tested back then, and we didn't have DNA analysis back then. We did have blood typing though, and they determined that the blood was type B. Terry was the only one that was type B at the scene. So it was presumed that that tiny drop of blood on his left pant leg was his own blood.
Wow.
So as police got nowhere, different media outlets started going door to door to talk to neighbors. They got some wild stories about the family and about Terry. Stories like Greg and his dad were sleeping with his aunt. And yeah, I don't know. One neighbor
What?
said they witnessed what they thought looked like a body being dragged out of the house that night, which doesn't make sense because none of the bodies were removed until, law enforcement got there. These allegations and rumors were unsubstantiated and just basically town talk. We come from a small town. You know how small towns can be. You pretty much know everybody. You start
Oh, yeah.
saying you're gleaning about people's characteristics and their personality, and you're just trying to piece it all together to basically figure out what the heck happened. I mean, you're trying to come up with
Right.
something. So, one such reporter that was going door to door was a man named Tom Stevenson with D Magazine. He began his own investigation and sort of made enemies with the Blue Mound Police Department, as you do. Yeah, as you do
Well, I
when
would
you're a
think
reporter
so.
and you're doing your own investigation. Now, Tom Stevenson is an important piece of this case because his investigation was independent, like I said, from po the police investigation. And he doesn't quite remember how he got a hold of this case. He couldn't believe, though, that police were pretty much just accepting Greg Joplin's account of that night. The more he had heard about it, the more he looked into it, he was like, something isn't right here. So, Tom Stevenson was from Dallas. He had the help of a former Dallas Police Department detective named Carl Feit, I believe it's pronounced. It's FITE. He ended up getting fired as a whistleblower. He not only helped Tom conduct the interviews in the case, but he had also investigated some of his own department's illegal activities. So, yeah, so he's like,
Oh,
basically, I don't really care. I'm looking for the truth, kind of a guy.
good for
As they're
you.
investigating, Tom and Carl were arrested for a few felonies, which included interfering with a murder investigation, and even one charge was enticing a child.
Interfering when you're
Right,
trying to find the
exactly.
truth,
The
help. I
enticing
mean.
a child charge piqued my interest a little bit. That charge was because after the murders, they had heard Greg was hiding out at a motel nearby. So they asked Terry Trice's girlfriend to come with them and like identify his car to see if he was there. So they took her with them to point out the car, but she wasn't able to find his car in the parking lot, so they just took her back home and dropped her off. This was a silly charge just to
Interesting.
basically get them to stop doing what they were doing. So they were
Right.
arrested and held in the Saginaw jail, which excited me a little bit because I've actually been to the Saginaw jail. Not I wasn't arrested, but a friend of mine was arrested. Yeah.
Okay, yeah,
We were
please
driving
clarify.
around one night doing some weird things. Like, maybe sometime I'll tell you guys about it. But we were pulled over and we were in her car, and she was arrested for like outstanding unpaid parking tickets or something like that. And so I know. So
Girl, y'all pay your tickets.
exactly. I feel like those days you had to mail it in. You know, these days you can just do everything
Oh,
online.
yes.
So, I mean, a little bit
Online.
of it was
It was
way
more
more
of
of
a
a hassle.
hassle.
But I ended up having to drive her car home, get my car, go to my house, and I'm talking, it was really late. Now I'm telling you more about the story. So, I'm going to get back to the story.
Okay.
Nevertheless, I've been to the Saginaw jail. That's my only connection to it. So back to the story, if you can even pay attention now. This reporter Tom and former detective were arrested, put in jail, but they were released after 11 hours. They put in a phone call to one of Tom's colleagues and they were able to get released. No formal charges were actually ever filed because the district attorney wouldn't accept Chief Irwin's complaints, like, get a life. I see what you're doing here. You're just trying
Good.
to stop them looking into this thing.
Right.
Exactly. And
Scandal.
the Tarrant County Sheriff at the time, Lon Evans, intervened and he made Chief Irwin and the arresting officers apologize to Tom and Carl. Boys, boys, say you're sorry. And after the apology, Lon and Tom sort of like got to talking, and they were talking about football and this and that, and then they started talking about the case, and more specifically about the guns that were found near Terry or on his person at the scene. Tom told Sheriff Evans how he had interviewed Terry's mother, and he said that she said Terry hated guns. He hated guns. His father
Okay.
apparently had completed
So.
suicide by shooting himself years earlier. So he hated guns
Oh.
and he didn't want anything to do with them. And she said he was unfamiliar with them. He had never liked them.
Okay, unfamiliar, but you're going to go in someone's house and shoot them point blank in the head
Right.
perfectly.
Exactly. Also, he had two weapons on him, so apparently he's unfamiliar with them, but he knows how to operate two different, a pistol and a rifle. Like, I don't even, I kind of know the difference between a pistol and a rifle, but I'm unfamiliar with guns, so
Yeah.
I wouldn't know how to use either one. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And Marie Rodriguez, the witness I told you about before, she was one of their neighbors. She gave an account that contributed to police timeline of events, saying at the time she knew that Terry was scared of guns too, and she had also pointed to his father's suicide as that being the reason, and she said there was no way he could have been responsible for the murders. Remember, Terry was found
Wow.
with two guns on him, and to me that's the hallmark of someone who's comfortable with guns. I probably
Right.
wouldn't carry one gun
Exactly.
around with me, let alone two, because I'm not familiar. I'm not comfortable. That's just me, though. That's just speculatory on my part. So let's talk about that rifle that was found near him. And it was deemed to be the weapon that was used in the murders of the Joplin family. I said before that it was an old British model 303 Enfield rifle. Well, Sheriff Evans explained to Tom that this gun is really tricky to load, and you have to like stagger the bullets when you're loading this gun. I actually needed to know a little bit more about what he meant by that, so I watched a really great YouTube video of a gentleman. He was great. I mean, he was like really into these guns. And there's a lot of videos out there about this particular rifle, but I watched this guy loading and shooting the gun, and he was telling all sorts of facts about the gun, how it was used in the world wars and such. It's a very old gun, so it has nuances to it. Definitely, you have to know what you're doing to use this gun. You have
Interesting.
to know
Okay.
how to load it in a very specific way. Like I said earlier, stagger the bullets or else they will get jammed and they won't shoot. And it's very, very loud, he said. This gun is very loud. So at this
Oh.
point, they're thinking it's not looking like Terry Trice could have done this. they're now starting to really scratch their heads and think, no, this isn't right. Something's wrong here. To correctly load this gun and accurately shoot four people in the head. Another thing I saw in multiple videos, this gun wasn't the most accurate shot. So even though it was used in the wars, they were highly trained to use this. And back in that day, I was talking about the nuances of these guns. You would have to know, okay, hold it a little bit to the left if you're looking through the scope and wanting to hit your target. You know what I mean? Those types of things. So you'd have had to been really experienced to shoot people in the head with this thing.
And so this
This was
was
Greg's
Greg's
gun.
gun.
Yes, it belonged to him. And
So it's not like Terry had taken the gun and practiced with it and then came back and shot them. I mean, like it was in their
right.
house, supposedly against the
So
front
this
door or
one was
behind the front
what
door.
was found next to him. Greg had several guns.
Okay.
This rifle was
Oh.
found next to Terry. You know how Greg says he gets home, he opens the door, he sees a shadowy figure with a
Okay.
gun. So this is
Right.
supposedly the gun that Terry had on him when he's coming towards Greg. And then there's a separate rifle, a 22, that he picked up that was supposedly propped up behind the front door. Two different rifles,
Okay,
and then,
gotcha.
of course, the pistol that was also on Terry at the time. Other details about the scene that are very interesting. Terry was wearing someone else's coat when he was found that night, and his mother said he left the house without shoes on. He was barefoot. This may not be a strange thing, but to me, it's February. Maybe it's strange, maybe it's not. But when he's found in the Joplin home, he's wearing shoes. The only problem is they're size 11, and he wears a size 9. This could also be speculation, but I
Okay.
think if he was familiar with his family, he gets there, he's barefoot, and they're like, "Sweet pea, you need to get some shoes on them feet. You probably stone cold." Maybe they gave him somebody's shoes. Maybe I would think
Wayne's
maybe
shoes.
Wayne was a size 11. I just think he, I don't know. I'm just making things
Maybe.
up at this point. So they probably lent him those shoes to wear. It was February after all, so maybe he wasn't wearing a coat either, and they gave him a coat as well. I don't know. I couldn't find any information as to,
Okay.
what they found out about those two details. And we had talked about the other victims and how they were all shot in the head, the Joplin family. But Terry's autopsy revealed a
Right.
single gunshot wound behind his ear. But Greg said he shot the intruder as he was coming towards him. So being shot behind the ear is impossible.
Right.
But there is more, Greg said, that doesn't add up. When he called the police department to report the murders, he told the dispatcher that his whole family was shot dead and that he ran out of the house and didn't go back in. He reiterated to the responding officers that he didn't go through the whole house. So how did he know his two brothers were dead too? How did he know that they were even home?
Wow.
Greg was subpoenaed to appear in front of a grand jury, and they had questions about his actions that night. Here's a short excerpt from that hearing. One juror asked, "Why didn't you run back to the bedroom to see if your brothers were all right?" Greg said, "All I wanted to do was call the police and get out of the house." The juror then asked, "You were so emotionally upset you felt like vomiting, but you could instantaneously recall the telephone number of the police department. Is that your testimony?" Greg said, "Yes, sir. It's not something you forget. I don't forget many phone numbers at all, but I made sure I memorized that one a long time ago. See, my mother attempted to commit suicide several months back, and at that point, I had to call the police too. And I had to be cool and tell them what had happened. At the same time, my dad had had a partial heart attack and fallen down on the floor. I had to be cool because there was no one else to do it." The juror then asked, "What made you think your mother hadn't committed suicide that night?" Greg said, "There wasn't time to consider."
And he had said she was hurt real
Exactly.
bad, not
So
even that she was dead.
from I didn't see a crime scene photo of Faye, but I did of the others. So I couldn't tell you what Faye's injuries were, her positioning. So I don't know what he says he saw that night. But this hearing was interesting. The grand jury were denied a lot of information that they requested. They wanted to go visit the house, the murder scene. They were denied. They wanted to review the medical examiner's autopsy reports. They were denied. Why? I don't know. It seems like every opportunity to actually solve this case was just slipping away at this time. Time was going on, and no one was charged. No further evidence came to light. And months after the murders, Chief Irwin resigned. I think this may have something to do with it. Greg moved away, he married, and he cashed in a $25,000 life insurance policy from his parents. Now, isn't
Well, how
that convenient?
convenient.
Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it would be worth over $130,000 today, easily, which back then, that was a lot of money, especially in their, let me put it this way, socioeconomic status, I guess you could say. Then something happened that made this case fall by the wayside. Another murder happened in Tarrant County in a $6 million mansion. So it was more high profile, it was more interesting.
Oh, okay. Because I thought at first you were going to say that it was they found out it was
That would
connected, but no,
be
it's just totally
so
different.
salacious, wouldn't it? No, I think they just got lured away. This was a little bit more interesting, sparkly, rich people, affluence. Yeah, I think they just were more interested in this case. They were just like, well, a bunch of lower class people. We'll get to this another time. I would love to cover this $6 million mansion case at some point, so it's on the list.
Let's do
But
it.
I want to fast forward to 2011. Police Chief Barry Hinkle and Detective Clifton Kirby reopened the case in 2011. They found a letter in the case file from 1978 that was written by an inmate named David Newberry to his wife, and he alluded to having information about the Joplin murders. So he was in jail with this guy named Cotton, and Cotton told Newberry that he had gotten high with Newberry's wife. Cotton had also told him
Small world.
guilt, right? I mean, yo, I got high with your wife. So Cotton had also told him that he had killed his ex-wife, who Newberry's wife also knew. No indication this letter was ever investigated back then. In addition to the jailhouse letter, Hinkle also found a sworn statement from back then, and let me read it for you. My full name is David Arnold Newberry. I am a white male, 27 years old. I was born August 27th, 51. I finished the sixth grade in school, and I can read and write the English language, but not very good. I'm presently in TDC at Huntsville, Texas. On December 4th, 1978, I was in the Tarrant County Jail at Fort Worth, Texas, in H Tank on the 7th floor. Also, a white male named Cotton, who was about 35, short, heavy build, and partially bald with gray hair, was in the same tank. We had been in this tank together for about a week. On December 4th, 1978, we were in Cotton's cell when Cotton began bragging about killing people. He told me that he had killed his wife named Portia because he was jealous of her and a guy named Mike, who had a funny name like Brazier. Cotton said he had killed a man named Bill Hatfield, but didn't say why he had done it. Then I asked Cotton, what does he get out of killing people? And he said, that ain't nothing. I could tell you something else. I asked him what he was talking about, and he said he could tell me about a family he had killed. I said, well, tell me then. And he said he had never told anyone, but it happened about 2 years ago. I said, man, tell me. I ain't gonna say nothing. Cotton asked me if I had ever had the urge to tell someone something that I had done, and I said yes. Cotton then said, the family's name was Joplin, and it happened in Blue Mound, Texas. I told him to go ahead and tell me the rest of it. I did not know about any family being killed at Blue Mound at the time Cotton was telling this to me. Cotton said that he had met about 3 times with one of the family members, a male, but Cotton didn't tell me his name. Anyhow, the Joplin man wanted Cotton to kill the rest of the family. so the Joplin man could get the insurance money and that he would pay Cotton for the killing out of the insurance money. Cotton didn't say how much money he was going to get for the killing. Cotton said the Joplin man was going to set up one of his friends to be blamed for the murders of the Joplin family. Cotton said he went to the Joplin house and went in to shoot the family. He said the Joplin man was waiting around the corner at a grocery store. Cotton said the Joplin man came into the home and had another young man with him. After the Joplin man and the other man got into the house, the Joplin man shot the young man who had come in with him, and at this time Cotton left. Cotton said that the Joplin man was going to call the police and tell them he had come home and found the other young man there and had shot him, and that he, the Joplin man, would call Cotton the next evening, and he did call. He told Cotton he would have the money in about a month or so. Cotton said that the Joplin man had only given him part of the money, and he got mad and told the Joplin man that he was going to go to the police. The Joplin man said, go ahead, because Cotton would get in trouble. About the time Cotton told me this, the jailers made us go to our own cells, and I didn't get to talk to him, Cotton, anymore. I think it's really funny that he said, we'll go right ahead. Please go to the
Yeah,
police
you're going
and
down.
tell
Yeah,
them
you're
that
going
I hired
down
you to
with
murder my family and I didn't pay you all of the money. Please go tell them that.
me.
That was a very interesting sworn statement. Would you believe me if I told you that at the time, back in 78, none of that information was investigated? So this was a
Okay.
sworn statement from an inmate who said he had information about the murders, gave a pretty detailed account about the murders.
Right.
I
Saying
mean,
that he had never
information.
heard about the murder in the first place. So the murder takes place in 76. This conversation between Newberry and Cotton happens in
Right.
78. And then this sworn statement is in
The sworn
2011.
it was in 78. Yeah, so
Okay.
he gives the sworn statement like right after. Like he goes
Okay, but then they just didn't go anywhere
right.
with this.
There's nothing to indicate that they tracked down this Cotton guy or what his real name actually was. So they didn't look into this at all back in 78. Well, fast forward to 2011, Hinkle did some digging, and that's when he found this sworn statement. He discovered a marriage license of a Portia Brusso and a Basil Steve Cotton. So Portia is the name of the ex-wife that Cotton was accused of murdering. That's why he was there in that jail at the time. So this fella Cotton had a slew of prior convictions. Everything from DWIs to aggravated battery, he had injury to a child, and of course, manslaughter.
Doesn't sound like a good
No,
character.
he's not somebody you would want to bring home to meet your parents, I would think. Both Cotton and Newberry were interviewed in 2011. They had both denied knowing anything about the murders, though Newberry didn't recant his original statement. So he just said, no, I don't know anything about that, but he didn't take back his original sworn statement. So I don't know why he acted like he didn't know what they were talking about, but nevertheless. So as far as getting any additional information in 2011, Hinkle found most of the relatives of the Joplin family were not very cooperative. But Greg's cousin Clara said she didn't believe that he had anything to do with the murders. And she was actually with him at his aunt's house that night of the murders. So she spent time with him, and for whatever reason, she feels like he couldn't have done it. So Greg himself actually died in 2005. So we're not getting any information out of him right now, and neither was Hinkle back in 2011. And that's one of the most frustrating things about cold cases. Suspects die, witnesses die. It's
Right.
hard to, really track down.
At this point, could they, you said Greg got married. I mean, could they not try to talk to his wife? And I mean, is she still alive? Maybe did he ever say anything
There's
to
no
her?
information to say that, but you know, it's so frustrating. They just like shelved this case for the more high-profile case, and all of that time that passed just basically erased any opportunity, essentially, to get to the truth. The more time goes by, like we said, people die, people forget things, people move, they're really hard to track down.
Right.
But you asked a really good question just now. Did his wife know anything? I really think that family secrets run deep. I feel like
Yes.
most people don't take things to their grave. People confide in someone. I mean, we as humans, that is a heavy burden to bear for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and you gotta get it off your
Exactly.
chest.
I do wonder if his wife knows something. I wonder if his kids maybe overheard something being said. Maybe his wife overheard him calling out in his sleep or something. You know what I mean? Like, there's got to be
Yeah.
some more information we can get. So I feel like the truth is out there somewhere. And I'll
Yeah.
say this because he's dead. I think the evidence points to Greg as the killer. That's speculation, so don't come at me.
Well, I will tell you, so my dad, he was actually friends with Brian, the
Wow.
middle son. And he actually lived across the street from them a year
That
before the
is
murders. He had
wild.
moved.
Can you imagine if he still lived there
Yeah, so,
at the time? He would have
right.
been all up on that.
I mean, oh
He's an
yeah,
amateur sleuth
Investigator
himself,
Allen.
so wow. So, did he have anything to say about this family?
Well, so I asked him about it because I knew when you told me you were going to be doing this case, I had asked him if he remembered it, and he said, "Oh yeah, I was friends with Brian, and my dad's older brother was friends with Kevin. I mean, not Kevin,
Greg,
Greg." So I asked him, "Did you think Greg did it? Did everybody around at the time think that Greg did it?" And he said, "Oh yeah."
That's so wild.
So yeah, and I'm like, okay, if everybody around thought Greg was the suspect, why would the investigators not,
Yeah.
like, why did they want to push it aside? Okay, yeah, the other
It
murder,
just feels
but
like this would have been, I don't want to say slam dunk, but I feel like it just would have been pretty cut and dry for the investigators. It
yeah.
doesn't seem like a far reach, you know? And no wonder he just moved away
Right.
because everyone thought he did it anyways, and he was just like, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Then, after the 2011 reopening of the case, remember Tom Stevenson with D Magazine, the guy who
Right.
got arrested,
Was
exactly,
thrown
for
in
silly
jail.
crime, silly charges, because he was actually doing his own investigation. Well, in 2018, he and the new police chief in Blue Mound, Randy Baker, went to re-interview good old Cotton.
Oh, cotton ball.
Cottonball. Cotton let them in, and when Tom and Chief Baker began asking him about the old murders, he got a bit perturbed. He said he wasn't going to talk about it, but you know, police usually just keep asking anyways. He said he didn't remember any details about the family, but he did remember that there was a family murdered on the same street as his ex-mother-in-law back in that day. He said he was in Atlanta when it happened, and when they pressed further, he said he was in Atlanta from 1971 till the mid-70s. And they said, okay, this happened in 76. Are you sure you weren't in Blue Mound at the time? You say mid-70s. That seems like 75. He didn't
Yeah.
remember because he was mostly drunk during the 10 years or so after Portia's death.
I mean, his mother-in-law lived on the
Right.
same street, and then he's talking about it 2 years
To
after.
it.
I mean,
So he
right.
says, yeah, I don't remember. And they were like, speaking of Portia, can you tell us about how she died? Well, that was a step too far. Because remember, He allegedly murdered her. So he got really pissed, and at that time, the interview was over. He ran them out the door pretty quickly. And in fact, Tom says that he was holding a dog, a little pit bull or something at the time, and he was like stroking the dog. And then at the time that he was like, okay, get out of my house, he just like let the dog go. So they were like, bye. And I'm really sorry to
Okay.
say, but that's the last development we have in this case. That's it. 2018 is the last time any action happened on this case. I spoke with Chief Steele at the Blue Mound Police Department, and there has been no movement, he confirmed, since 2018. And unfortunately, I think they're pretty much at a standstill until something new comes to light.
Which probably won't unless they talk to either Greg's ex-wife or wife, or if Cotton, if anybody knew Cotton and if he talked about it with anybody, like, unless somebody from those points of views talk, then it's nothing else is going to happen with it.
I know it really sucks. And they did mention that in the 2018 interview, he was on oxygen, so he's probably not in great health. But
Right.
at this point, I think he's still alive from what I could find. Their suspicions are pretty pointed to who may have done this, and I think it's our
Right.
same suspicions. And you can decide for yourself based on the evidence provided in this episode. Let's talk about motive for just a second. Shortly after the murders, Greg told the grand jury that he was upset with his mom because he felt like she was spending frivolously. He had referred to her spending the family's income and also some money that she had inherited from her sister's estate. And let's not forget that Greg got a life insurance policy on them. Not a lot, but for back then, it was a pretty good amount. I guess enough for him to hightail it out of town and start a new life. And like you said, your dad and everybody pretty much thought he did it. So he had no motivation to stick around. I mean, he probably didn't want to be in that house that he had done what he did in. And by all accounts, Hinkle thinks Newberry was telling the truth in that sworn statement. I mean, he had details that he wouldn't have had unless he was either there or told firsthand by somebody who was there. I mean, back then there was no internet. You couldn't just go on and in the jail and research, and find. And I even struggled finding really good information on this case. There wasn't much action, anyways, on the case after that other murder happened. So they were just like moving on to
So
bigger
sad.
and better things. It is so sad. And in cases like this, they just linger in the back of your mind, like how did they let the murders just fall by the wayside? I don't get it.
Well, and not just that, I mean, I feel terrible for the victims, but Terry's mother, like, this is her son, and his name
I mean,
is.
I think I read something where she has passed away, but to die knowing that your son's name was never cleared
Oh, I feel
of,
awful for her.
from the witness testimonies, none of the neighbors believed that he did it. So they probably knew his character and whatever, but his family deserves closure. And a 6-year-old boy was murdered.
For sure.
A little baby 6-year-old boy.
Yeah.
I wonder if just the 6-year-old boy, if he had been murdered, if something might have come from the investigation, if it would have been taken more seriously, if it wouldn't have been so
Right.
sloppy and botched, and it's just so sad.
It is.
But if you have any information at all, big or small, that could help solve this cold case, this is over 46 years old. Please reach out to Detective Leggett, that's LEGGETT, with the Blue Mound Police Department at 817-232-0661.
Thanks, guys, for
Thanks for
listening.
listening, and don't forget to check us out on Instagram. What's our Instagram again, Lena?
Cousins on Crime Podcast.
That was good. That sounded like a recording. Cousins on Crime podcast for Instagram, and also send us an email, cousinsoncrime@gmail.com, if you have any cases that you think we should cover, or if you have any feedback for us. We are noobs, so we would love to hear your gentle,
Constructive
constructive criticism.
criticism.
Don't be mean. Don't be mean, because I'll just put it in the trash. I won't even read it if you're gonna be mean. Thanks, guys. See you
Toodles.
next week.
Bye
Bye-bye
now.
now.